May what I speak, may what you hear, be in the name of the God of love, who creates, redeems, and sustains every single one of us. Amen. Please be seated. Some verses from that Gospel, Luke chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Now all the tax collectors and the sinners were coming near to listen to Jesus, and the Pharisees and the scribes, they were grumbling, and they were saying, "This fellow welcomes sinners, and he eats with them." Can you believe it? I just added that bit in myself. This morning, I want to talk to you about Jesus. About Jesus. I want to talk about Jesus because he's up to his old tricks again, isn't he? In the Gospel. He's getting himself in trouble again, isn't he? Jesus is upsetting the religious leaders again. Very bad thing to do, that, upset religious leaders, by the way. And it's all to do with the company he's keeping. Or rather, it's all to do with the bad company he's keeping. He is, as we heard, he is hanging out with sinners. In fact, he's not just hanging out with them. He is eating with them. He's sharing his table with them. And just so we're clear, these are not necessarily reformed sinners either, you understand. These are not necessarily ex-sinners. These are current sinners, practicing sinners, you know. People like tax collectors, hated tax collectors, working for the hated occupying Romans, the pagan Romans. Can you believe it? People like prostitutes. People like, well, people who have taken all sorts of wrong turnings in their lives. And yet Jesus welcomes them. He welcomes them to break bread with him. And that was a really, really shocking thing for a religious leader to do. In contrast, the scribes and Pharisees, they would never dream of doing such a risky, shocking thing. Though the scribes and Pharisees, they were far more careful, far more cautious about who they ate with, who shared their table, but not Jesus. Not so Jesus. So the obvious question, I suppose, is why? Why does Jesus do this? Why does he eat with these sinners? Well, wonder no longer, because he tells us. He tells us why. He tells us why in his favorite way of answering questions, by telling us some stories, yeah? By telling us two parables. So let's have a look again at his two parables. Before I get into the details, just a general point about parables. I think one of the great difficulties, or challenges at least, of reading and understanding the Bible today is that the way we might react today to a certain parable is sometimes very, very different to how the original people 2,000 years ago might have reacted to a parable, you know? I think many of us have heard these parables so often that we've kind of become immune to them, yeah? We kind of know them. We think we know them so well that maybe we become immune to their shock factor. We become immune to just how strange they are, how disturbing they are, how shocking they are. I say that because this morning's two parables, the lost sheep and the lost coin, are perfect examples of this. So let me explain what I mean. Let's start with the parable of the lost sheep. You see, I think for many of us, when we today hear the story of the shepherd who leaves the 99 sheep in the wilderness to go and search for the one lost sheep, I think we nod our heads and go, "Isn't that lovely? Isn't that wonderful? What a lovely shepherd that is. What a wonderful shepherd." But the problem is, I think that the first hearers of the parable 2,000 years ago would have had a very, very different reaction. Think about it. Here's a shepherd with 100 sheep, decent enough flock, and one of them, just one, gets lost. So what does he do? He leaves. He abandons, you might say, the 99, we're told, in the wilderness. In the wilderness, notice. He leaves the 99 and he goes off on a wild goose chase. Or rather, a wild sheep chase, I suppose. In other words, the shepherd leaves 99 sheep unattended. He leaves them unattended, unprotected, liable to wander off God knows where, liable to be attacked by wolves, liable to be stolen by thieves. So I think the first hearers of this parable would have been gobsmacked at such a shepherd. I think the first hearers would have thought to themselves, well, I don't know any shepherds like that. The shepherds I know, they would have thought, are in the sheep business to make money. And the cool-headed business decision is that sometimes you have to sacrifice one to save 99. That's just cold economic common sense. Harsh maybe, but that's life. So as I say, the first hearers, I think, would have been quite shocked. They would have been scratching their heads thinking, what is Jesus getting at here? This isn't a normal shepherd. And it's something similar with the second parable, the story of the lost coin. You remember how it goes. A woman has 10 silver coins. That's quite a lot, because she's lots of other coins too, no doubt, if she's got silver ones. So pretty wealthy woman. And as we heard, when one of the coins disappears down the back of the sofa, so to speak, you know how it happens, this woman, she totally overreacts. First, she tears the house apart. And then when she finds the coin, she throws a big party for all her friends and neighbors. It's like as if, you know when you find 100 kroner in your pocket that you didn't know was there, or in a jacket pocket? It's like as if you found 100 kroner and then invited 50 of your closest friends for a glass of champagne. People would think you had lost your mind. That's how shocking and strange this parable is. And so again, as with the lost sheep parable, the first hearers, I think, would have been scratching their heads thinking, that doesn't sound very prudent to me. That doesn't sound very careful to me. That doesn't sound very sensible to me. Or let me put it this way, neither the action of the shepherd nor the actions of the woman would come out very well from a cost-benefit analysis. You weigh up the cost and the benefit. But that, of course, that's precisely the point, isn't it? These parables are reminding us that the God we see and experience in Jesus is not prudent or cautious or carefully calculating of risk and reward. No, in fact, the God we see in Jesus overturns that whole worldly way of thinking. After all, there's nothing cautious. There's nothing cautious about welcoming sinners to your table in defiance of powerful religious leaders who may one day make you pay for breaking their rules. That's not cautious. There's nothing prudent or careful about standing for truth and peace in a world ruled by the violence and half-truths of the Roman Empire. There's nothing calculating about laying down your life for your friends. There's nothing calculating about giving your life away in love for others. In short, the God we see in Jesus is not a God of half measures and careful calculation. No, the God we see in Jesus is a God of reckless compassion, extravagant mercy, over the top love. And a good job too. And a good job too. Because that's the kind of God we need. I don't know about you, but the more I see of life, my own, other people's, I'm more and more convinced that if we are ever to have the courage to face the messes we've made, to face the sins we've committed, to face the mistakes we've made, and to have the courage to face them and try and change, if we're ever to allow the cold, hard shell of our selfishness to be broken open, if we're ever to be the people we know in our hearts we were made to be, then we need a recklessly compassionate God who never, ever, 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 ever gives up on us. We need a God like that shepherd who throws common sense and careful calculation to the wind, and chases us down and carries us home. We need a God like that woman who pulls her house apart to search for us, and then when she finds us, she blows the housekeeping budget on a party. We need a God like Jesus who will spare nothing, not even his life, spare nothing in order to show us just how far love will go to save us. The truth of the gospel is this: in Jesus, we have just such a God. Let us never forget it. Amen.